stand to sing our first hymn. Because Malcolm was bright, because he was beautiful, we sing all things bright and beautiful.
I've got to say, he was one of the few really naturally funny people. Usually when you judge that, you would maybe write down their material or describe to someone what they did. And as you were saying it, it's one of those real had to be there moments. You go, and then he did this, and you realise, that's not funny, that's really dull. But somehow seeing Malcolm do it, and I'm not doing a whole because he's dead, he was so much better than everyone else, because he certainly wasn't. He was essentially rubbish and lazy and oafish and all the worst things you'd want from a comic. And yet, times you just watch him and go, God, there's a real magic there that, you know, can't be learnt and can't be bought. And if only he'd put some effort in, he really would have been one of the great comics, maybe. But he never was going to, which is sort of what made him so delightful.
The idea of a comp is actually to make the other acts look good. Success. And the other idea is to warm you up. So on the door, on the count three, that's a whole audience, all 87 of you, count it in the pocket. So on the count three, the whole audience suddenly just clapped you and go dessert. So here we go, on the count three, the whole audience clapped you and go dessert. One, two, three!
Even if he... a situation ended in a fight. Malcolm didn't want there to be unhappiness. He wanted there to be chaos. He liked when everything went wrong. He was bored when everything went smoothly.
Yes, I am the co-host, the sort of secular vicar. Thank you, Father Peter. We're a bit of a double act this morning. Yes, the Lord God, whoever you may be, you did make the little flowers that open, you did make the little bird that sings, and then you had a couple of pints and you made Malcolm harder. Everything about Malcolm, except his stand-up material, was original. He was the most extraordinary man. So let's just start off, release a little tension by sitting back and looking and giving a huge round of applause for the most remarkable person that a lot of us have ever met.
This is the standing ovation at the start of the funeral of Malcolm Hardy at St Alphege's Church in Greenwich last February. Hardy, with two E's and sometimes more, was a comic, promoter and agent, famous, if not to the public, then to a whole universe of comedians who knew him and played his notorious clubs, the Tunnel Palladium and Up the Creek. There are dozens of anecdotes about this South London Falstaff, and you're about to hear some of those that are broadcastable. He looked like a debauched Eric Morecambe, glasses oddly large so that you rarely saw his eyes. His standard uniform was a stained, shiny suit that had once fitted a smaller man. Malcolm was there at the start of the alternative comedy scene, regularly playing the Comedy Store in the early 80s. Unlike his fellow performers, he had not gone to college or drama school. He was engaged elsewhere, as he told me when I interviewed him on Radio 4 in 1996.
Tell us about your life of crime, Malcolm.
My life of crime? Well, that really wasn't very successful.
No, because you end up in Nick for 7 years or something.
Yeah, seven and a half. Not all in one go.
Mainly for nicking cars?
Yeah, but it builds up, doesn't it?
Well, you quite like playing the villain, don't you? Lovable rogue.
Yeah, a little bit.
But the point about being a lovable rogue is the rogue part's fairly easy. It's the lovable bit that you get away with quite well, Malcolm.
After prison, Malcolm teamed up with Martin Sohn, who performed a pornographic Punch and Judy act. Together, they formed the greatest show on legs, a shambolic sketch show.
Where we're similar is that we would do anything for a laugh, you know. But our relationship depended upon him making me angry and making me do all the work. He'd just come up with an idea, and then, for example, we did this one, a pastiche of the Red Arrows. He said, I've got an idea, Mark. We'll do the Red Sparrows to 633 Squadron. So that was it. So I said, I go off, make a load of Red Sparrows, tiny ones that were held in the hand, and came together. There was three of us in the Greatest Show on Legs, and we did these sort of patterns with these little Red Sparrows to the music, you know. And so he'd come up with an idea like that. I'd do all the work. He'd take all the glory. Always.
Martin and Malcolm's greatest glory came with the balloon dance, a naked cha-cha-cha performed with the dexterous use of balloons. It scandalised the TV audience when it was first seen on Chris Tarrant's OTT and was described by Clive James as the funniest cabaret act I've ever seen.
He wasn't a very good comedian at all. He certainly wasn't a very good thief, because he kept on getting caught. Useless thief, useless comedian, and a useless businessman. I mean, we signed a contract for them and we got £300, and that was it. Now, that programme, that sketch, the balloon dance was on, has been sold all over this world, all over this world. They would just buy that programme, buy the whole programme, chuck all of it away and just show our balloon dance. When we did Sweden, we were national heroes. They'd been showing the balloon dance on nationwide Saturday night television every Saturday for 9 months. We walked into the sort of like the Woolworths in Sweden. They've got balloons with the Ballongen dance and balloons, you know, with the steps, our steps on it and stuff like that, on the cardboard bit that they staple onto the cellophane package with the balloons in, you know. It was at the beginning of all that so-called alternative movement and stuff like that. There was the Goodies or Monty Python that we could have been compared to, but there was something very anarchic about the Great Charlotte's as well. It was completely disrespectful. We prided ourselves on our unprofessional attitude. We had no talent. We prided ourselves on these things. And rather trying to be intelligent, rather trying to fit in, rather than trying to write material all the time, you know, we actually lived a life that supplied all that for us.
In 1984, Malcolm opened a weekly comedy club called the Tunnel Palladium at the Mitre, a big pub placed squarely on a windswept wasteland by a gasworks and the southern entrance to the Blackwall Tunnel in Greenwich. He couldn't find a compere, so he did it himself every Sunday for the next 5 years.
So I'm warming up a bit now. I'm warming up. That was a heckle. It wasn't a nice heckle, but it wasn't bad. And you're the man who comes with the tallest woman in the world, just.
Malcolm was... Well, he was completely unlike anything else. Firstly, I'd never been to a comedy club before, or any comedy clubs that had made me laugh. Secondly, the way that Malcolm held it all together from the very beginning was completely unique and just made it utterly compelling.
Glenn Tilbrook, singer with Squeeze.
I remember taking some friends who'd come over from Australia down to the tunnel. I think Chris Lynham was booked to appear, but didn't show. So Malcolm did the finale, which involved being naked and sticking fireworks up his ass. Now, Chris Lynham, of course, was very practiced at this. Malcolm was not. So there were fireworks exploding from his bottom, and he was hurting himself. But it was all somehow brilliant. I've never seen anything like that before or since.
Still not really good. I've had a hard week, and the mum died, and a bloody cot death, and everything.
A club is often a reflection of its compere or its owner.
Comedian Simon Munnery.
The people that come each week, they were a reflection of Malcolm, a sort of bright, I mean, the brightest crowd. They used to swear a lot and throw things, but they weren't thick. And they knew what they liked, and what they didn't like was people just coming down trotting out their acts. That's the one thing you couldn't do. I mean, I was there one night and they heckled everyone off, every single top acts from the comedy circuit at the time. Top acts, every single act was off within 20 minutes. That's the whole evening over within 20 minutes. And it didn't feel like, oh dear, what a disastrous night. It felt like a victory to the Tunnel Club. We've got death to entertainment. They didn't really want to be entertained. They wanted to see blood or something. They used to chant, stone him, or crucify him. It was quite biblical. Burn him, burn the witch. Amazing. And heckles in Latin, I remember hearing.
And there would be really clever heckling.
Jeremy Hardy.
I was just holding the microphone stand and someone shouted, let go of the mic stand, you're showing your insecurity. They used to do a very cruel thing at the tunnel, which was to boo people back on. They'd give people an encore and then you'd see the look on someone's face thinking, that went much better than I thought it did because they've given me an encore. And it was so that they could get the person back on to give them more abuse.
So there you are, it's inside the pin in the front. The next act on tonight, a person who years ago did the open spot, did it 3 or 4 times, died to death, came back to the proper booking, went down well. A very good act. Will you please welcome onto the stage, he's an urban warrior. He's from the street. That's the sort of person he is. Will you please welcome Simon Munnery?
So I start doing it quite slow and I'm getting really quiet and not working at all.
No, mate, you're just pretending. But I don't blame you for that. Many an evening I've pretended to be Jimmy Percy myself.
And then this heckling starts, but someone goes,
after Simon Munnery,
I'll pay. So will I. Pass the hat round.
I'll pay for it.
Oh, God.
Pass the hat round. Yeah, thanks for your heckles. Shouldn't be heckling me, it should be them out there you're heckling. Bear that in mind.
Well, you're shit, they're not.
The Tunnel was a club in Malcolm's image. Vulgar, witty, unpredictable, with an air of lawlessness. It was the edgiest gig in town, and it became a badge of honour to have played there, a badge earned by some well-known names.
Harry Enfield, Lenny Henry, Nigel Planer.
What was Harry Enfield like when he first played here? Because he wasn't very well known then.
First, he was in a double act called Dusty and Dick. We tried out the Stavros here.
I remember seeing Loads of Money.
Loads of Money
down
here.
Yeah.
For the first time.
Joe Brand, of course, used to work down here.
She did. Fritz Reeves.
Yeah.
I used to hate him.
Did they?
Yeah.
Why?
He was a bit too avant-garde for him, I suppose, or not funny enough or something. But I put him on in Bracknell, and I put him on in the audience, actually signed a petition saying they never wanted to see him in the building again.
Do you ever notice, Malcolm, that a lot of the people you've introduced and indeed worked with have gone on to become much more famous, successful and rich than you?
Yeah. Of course I've noticed.
Malcolm gave Loads of new acts a break, including the young Mark Lamar, who played the Tunnel the night that Malcolm showed his displeasure at an audience member who'd fallen asleep by urinating over him from the stage.
Because I remember that night so well. Of all the thousands of gigs I did, he was actually quite a young bloke and quite well turned out, but obviously he couldn't hold his drink. And I remember so vividly, because there were only about six of us left in the club when he woke up. One of his friends was still there and like nudged him and finally got him awake. And I could see from a distance that they were miming. This very strange mime of like, and you were asleep and then this man did this and then you were covered in his urine. And there was this just bizarre reaction where the bloke sort of looked down and did a little gesture of like, what me? And then was just, hey, just delighted that he'd been such a big part of the show. But I will never, ever, ever forget that. I don't care what happens in my life. If I see Martians riding Loch Ness down my street, I would still go, yeah, but until you were there.
He did have an eye for talented people, but he also had an eye for untalented people who just did something peculiar. Just because it makes life more interesting that somebody is a one-off and a bit strange, you know, where you're not quite sure how much the persona is real and how much that person is just a bit mental. And people liked him, and because he looked after people and he cared for people, people were drawn to him and felt protected by him.
Yeah. There have been some terrible acts down there, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. You had Madden Poulet and a singing chicken.
Yeah, and what did Madden Poulet do?
Well, I got up and she put a little... There's a little screen she's got on stage, about 3 foot high, sort of an inverted V sort of thing with a chicken behind it and a chair. She got the chicken up over the thing and then just started singing Je ne regrette, right, all in French. After about 2 minutes, about five blokes at the back all at once just went clack, 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 clack off. And off she went. I haven't seen her again.
He's part of comedy history. He is part of what made it all happen. His club was one of the few clubs actually in London at that time.
Malcolm had that talent to get people down there, and he would always, I mean, he persuaded Squeeze to play there, and we never got paid, but we didn't mind. That was all right. It was Malcolm Singh.
The keyboard player for Squeeze, Jules Holland, was also a client of Malcolm's.
When he lived opposite, he said, we could do some shows. And well, I'd never toured with Malcolm before, and I was used to sort of, Malcolm was a tour manager and agent.
And
I was
support
used
act.
And support act and MC.
Yeah, and played in the band at the end.
Yeah, but the point was that he said I was used to the high quality tour managing. You know, I was used to things happening on time, synchronised, well-oiled machine. And as we were left, he couldn't drive as well at that time for various reasons. So I had to drive, which is normally the tour manager's job. So I was driving, and as we started to pull away, he said, "I just want to stop somewhere in Greenwich and get something." And so we got to near where his house was. He said, "Stop here," which was a skip. And he then got from the back of this skip a tent and started putting it in the boot of the car. And I said, "What are you doing with that?" He said, "Well," I said, "you stay in all these posh hotels, wasting your money. I'm going to pitch this in the gardens of the hotels." And so for the first sort of four shows, he did that, and we'd sort of peer outside around the curtains of our hotel, and there'd be this sort of half-blown-over tent, and the people at the hotel would get a bit grumpy, but somehow they got over that. And that is what sums Malcolm up. You can't quite understand how that happened. If we look at just momentarily, not that I wish to embarrass, at Malcolm's beautiful wife, Jane. We ask ourselves, how?
Yeah.
What does she see in him?
Charm, isn't
it? Charm, that's right. And that's why we love Malcolm. Somehow, it always works out in the end.
The first time I spent any great deal of time with him was we went up to Manchester for a week to film some TV show. It would have been the first one that certainly that I'd have been on.
Mark Lamar.
We're all in this hotel, went to bed, would have been about two, I'd imagine, when the bar closed, and I'm fast asleep, and then there's loads of clanging and banging on my door. It probably would have been about 4 or 5 in the morning by this point. When I get to the door, and of course, oi, oi. So I open the door, and there's Malcolm with a sock on his penis. And I know everyone's got a story about Malcolm with a sock on his penis, or maybe less dressed than that, but that's all he had on. And what had happened was he'd fallen asleep, got up to go to the toilet, of course had then walked out his hotel door rather than go into the bathroom, and wandered around in his socks. And there was a big ballroom in this hotel, and he said, oh, I wonder through the ballroom. And then I thought, sock on my knob. So he took off one of his socks to somehow make him look, you know, much more debonair and like the gentleman of the evening that he was. So he just, all he wanted was to use the phone. So yeah, and he went, good to tell. So I, you know, I'm still fast asleep. I just grabbed like, this tiny little hand towel and went back to sleep. And at the time I would have been about 20 or something. I don't know how old Malcolm was. And he said when they came to give him his key and let him out, it looked like just the weirdest gay scene gone wrong. Because I'm like, I'm fast asleep in bed, and Malcolm's standing there with basically a flannel, and that was all he had. But it was exactly the sort of thing, if you stayed in a hotel room with Malcolm, that will happen.
Malcolm had enemies. Among them were fear, embarrassment and cleanliness. But there is one word that often comes up when his name is mentioned. Somehow, as in, somehow we ended up in Istanbul, or somehow, mostly, he got away with it. Mark Steele.
For example, I mean, Mountain was sort of ringing me up at one point. You want to come out on this boat? I've got this boat. And then when you think of it, you sort of think, if someone was to invite you out on the boat, that sounds like the most middle-class sedate, suburban, sort of Terry and Junie, good lifey thing. We must go out on our boat. And of course, with Malcolm, the most opposite to that you could imagine. So you go out on this little thing that's about 4 foot long, and it's just got a little engine in the back. And it's going in all directions. And at one point you think, this can't be right. And it's a little bit windy and it's sort of nearly tipping up and you're nearly going under. And you remember reading all these things. 4 people a week are drowned in the Thames, you know. And you think, and Mountain's just going, oh, Mr. Christian, all this. And we managed to get as far as Wapping, and then the engine conks out and we floated into this extraordinary pile of rubbish, and it was right next to this sort of floating police station that they've got there. And after a while the police start coming round, like, you know, what are you doing over there, these people on this sort of completely useless, hideous 3 bits of floorboardy boat that's bobbling up and down in about 8 foot of rubbish, what are you doing at? So Mountain straight away, my name is Mr. Kennedy or whatever. And then these coppers come on and somehow they start kneeling down and fiddling in the water. I know what your trouble is, Mr. Kennedy. It's a bit of a, you've got a bit of a screw loose there in your gasket. And I thought, I mean, all the coppers I have ever met have been like these horrible stroppy bits. And somehow, within Malcolm, there's a bloke who's kneeling, all getting soaked in the middle of all this rubbish, looking for a screw. Oh, and then after a half an hour or two, what, Mr. Kennedy, I don't think we went out to get this going. I'll give you a tow back. Where did Woolwich. Oh, well, right, well, we can go to Woolwich. And he puts this thing, he ropes it up to the back of the police boat and starts towing us back. And then this copper says, I've devised a quiz. And I thought, what? And Mountain's going, oh, I love a quiz. And he starts reading these 20 questions out about the bloody river. And it wasn't until we'd sort of, you know, you'd get home and you think, of course, a day out on a boat with Malcolm. That is, you know, anybody else, a day out on a boat, oh, here we are, I've got this lovely sort of £250,000 horrific monstrosity of an object. But with Malcolm, it just ends up in this surreal Monty Python sketch. Of course it did.
Although Malcolm left prison in 1977, he never really lost his fondness for thieving. Nick Wiltsey.
I had a really bad toothache. This is when I was living with him. I had a terrible toothache. I know I hadn't been to a dentist for years and years, and I didn't have a local dentist. So I booked this one round the corner, and he said, no, you're going to need to be knocked out for this. You know, it's like major stuff. So I'll book you in this afternoon. Now what you need is a responsible adult to take you there and look after you, because once you've taken this gas stuff, you know, you're going to be a bit woozy. So I went back home. I said to Malcolm, can you take me to a dentist? I need a responsible adult. And he went, well, I'm an adult, but... So, of course, he did. He took me down there, sat in the waiting room, you know, sort of wake up, and you sat next to Malcolm. He said, you ready to go? I went, yeah. Anyway, it was only when we got back home I realised there's no money in my wallet and all the credit on my phone's gone. So Malcolm's probably just thought, well, Wally's asleep. He won't notice it, will he? It don't matter to him. He wouldn't think twice about that, you know. Yeah, you forgive him for it because it's funny. You think, well, you sort of expect that. If you're with Malcolm and you're unconscious at some point, of course he's going to take your wallet.
You're not on yet.
I'm going to introduce Stuart Lee.
Doesn't say that here.
It was a fantastic funeral and even had a comedy vicar, Father Peter, with whom I seemed to form a bickering double act.
Stuart Lee, where is Stuart? Follow that.
Consider Malcolm Hardy. Malcolm Hardy of where, Lord, interrupted Peter. All the others have been of somewhere. The birds of the air, the lilies of the field. You've established a formula, you have to run with it. It's the rule of three. Very well, continued Jesus. Consider Malcolm Hardy of South London. He does not sow nor reap, nor store away in barns. He does not labour or spin. He does not take meetings or do lunch or hone his act. And yet, did he not go on at midnight at Glastonbury, year after year after year, with nothing more than a harmonica, some luminous paint, and the opening line, I remember when this was all fields.
Malcolm's material was, his opening thing was, all right, my name's Malcolm Hardy, I'm your comp bear for the next 9 years. Joke number one, rose are red, violet's blue, I'm dyslexic, blah, 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 blah.
And so I say to you, do not worry, saying what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear, or once we're up on stage in front of thousands of paying punters, what shall we actually say?
He used to do jokes he'd stolen, maybe some of them were his own, but I doubt it, and it didn't matter. Bit of harmonica playing, blues, the Deptford blues. I met my wife in Melbourne. I said, what are you doing here? At his best, he was hilarious. As I say, I've got a tape, I can prove it. But not on any legal broadcast medium.
Do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. Oi, oi.
Malcolm liked the harmonica, although his efforts were nothing like as good as Al's, a musician friend who played at his funeral. We're not here to canonise Malcolm. In many ways, he was a shyster and a pain in the arse who drank too much and mumbled incomprehensibly. He owed everyone money, which had often been disposed of in the betting shops of South London. Yet, somehow, he provided a cockeyed inspiration to a generation of comedians and their audiences. His anarchic spirit remains, even though he has gone, and his big, beautiful glasses lie somewhere at the bottom of his beloved River Thames.
He really liked and didn't have a go at anybody, really. He always allowed them to be who they were and never got annoyed with them or never got angry with them. He was rock solid like that. The small man, the man that everyone ignores, he wouldn't forget. He wouldn't forget. He would go around there and have a cup of tea with the guy, you know what I mean?
He was probably the most loved person. Malcolm Hardy and Paul Foote are the two most loved people I've ever known. I mean, that funeral, I think most of the comics there just thought, I'm not going to bother to die now because he's just done this so brilliantly. And it was horrible the way he died, and we can all make jokes about what a way to go and all that, and it's very sad, and it does make me very sad to think that it must have flashed through his very drink-sodden mind, I really had it this time at some point. But he was very important and influential, and he was around at the time when I started, so I had to go and pay respect to Malcolm for the help and encouragement that he gave me, and for the, you know, for the warmth and friendship that he showed me as well.
I think Malcolm had an enormous bank of goodwill with people, certainly in South East London, for what he'd brought to the area, all the while leading this sort of chaotic life. And I think his bank of goodwill extended a tremendous amount, but perhaps was diminishing slightly towards the end. I'm sorry to say that, but I think it was. You know, it's very true to say sometimes you don't realise the value that someone's had in your life until they're gone, and I think everyone loved Malcolm and everyone was aware of that, but I don't think anyone was aware of the big hole he'd leave by not being there, and I really felt that day, and I've felt it quite a lot since.
And may you know everlasting life. Alleluia! Alleluia! Hallelujah.
And then finally, Malcolm's coffin was carried out to a tune he'd selected years before.